Last week, we saw how the way in which John structures these middle chapters of the gospel drives towards the aim of the whole gospel. There's the aim of the gospel up on the screen for you, the end of chapter 20. Now, Jesus did many other signs which are not written in this book, but these are written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. So when you're reading John's Gospel, that's what you're meant to get out of it. Those are the questions you're meant to be addressing. And chapter by chapter, in this middle section, I say, John gives us this scheme. We have a sign. Last week it was a healing. Today we have the feeding of the 5,000. We then have a private miracle for the disciples. We'll think about that again in a moment. We then have a big teaching section in which Jesus picks up some of the questions that the people were asking, some of the issues that arise from their response to what he's done. And then there is the final response, which invariably is about believing or not believing, accepting or rejecting Jesus. Now tonight, we'll only have time to go up to the end of the second sign. Chapter 6 is longer than chapter 5, and there's also quite a bit of Old Testament background we need to get our heads around. So we'll just do that tonight. Let's begin with the Old Testament to begin with. It seems though John is using the escape from Egypt, the beginning of the Exodus, as the sort of structure for what happens here in chapter 6. In verse 4, there's mention of the Passover. Then there's references to the feeding in the wilderness. Jesus meets the people in their hunger on the mountainside. And then there's the miracle of walking on water, which may be a reference to Israel crossing the Red Sea on dry land behind Moses, or it may be just a sign of a further test that Jesus is giving to them. The disciples appear three times in the chapter, at the beginning where they ask, Jesus challenges them to provide bread. Then in the middle, when he challenges them for being afraid of his appearing before them on the lake. And then at the end, when he says to them, do you want to go as well? So maybe it's all about the testing of the disciples than anything else. But throughout the chapter, John keeps his focus on Jesus, what he's doing, the signs he's offering, and what the signs tell us about the sign giver. And as we saw last time, the questions that he's leaving the disciples, those who are with him, and of course us, are these. Which Jesus will you believe in? Do you want the sign, or do you want the sign giver? And that's really going to come to a head at the end of the chapter, and we'll look at that next time. First of all, then, let's have a look at the sign. And let's have a look at Jesus the provider in verses 1 to 13. And I'm sure, as you probably know, this is the only miracle that occurs in all four of our Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke and John. And it's not hard to see why. Because as Jesus provides for the people on a hillside in the wilderness, he makes a most explicit claim to be God. For those of you who like a bit of geography and a bit of scene setting, here is a shot of the Golan Heights above the Sea of Galilee where this particular miracle took place. For those of us who can remember the 1970s, Golan Heights means something else, but we'll leave that aside just for the moment. You can get rid of that now, Chick. Thanks. That's great. In order that we make the connection with what has gone on in the Old Testament, John verse 4 says, the Passover, the feast of the Jews, was at hand. And the vegetation bears that out. You may have wondered why on earth in verse 10 did we know that there would need to know there was much grass in the place. Mark in his gospel tells us it was green. Well, why do we need to know that? Because that just confirms the time of year. Any later in the year, it would have been scorched by the sun. no grass, and certainly nothing green. Now, Passover was a time of national remembrance. And it was a time of nationalistic zeal. And that may well account for the intention among the people to try to make Jesus king in verse 15. It was the annual celebration of the miracle of the rescue from Egypt, the death of the firstborn, where every house that didn't have its lintels, doorposts painted with the blood of the lamb suffered the death of the firstborn. Then, having escaped from Egypt in the wilderness, God tested the people and provided for the people. He sent them manna and quail and gave them water. Now, earlier in John, in chapter 1, can we have the pictures back, please? That's great. Earlier in chapter 1, John the Baptist has already identified Jesus as the Passover lamb, the lamb that will take away the sin of the world, the one who one day himself will die to rescue the people. And here John is saying he's not just that, he's more than that. He's also the God who provides for his people. So in verse 6, he's testing his disciples. He says to Philip, verse 5, "Where are we to buy bread so that these people may eat?" Verse 6, he said this to test him, for he himself knew what he would do. And what he will do is not, as you may have heard from your RE teacher at school, a sort of glorified bring and share lunch. He didn't say, "Okay, time to get your sandwiches out and share them with everybody else." That's, strangely enough, not what happens. Look at verse 11. He provides for them. Jesus took the loaves, and when he'd given thanks, he distributed them to those who were seated. So also the fish, as much as they wanted. And then later, verse 19, they saw Jesus walking on the sea. Jesus is the one to whom these Old Testament narratives are pointing. He is the one who fulfills this Old Testament story of rescue. And he has come to bring a new salvation, a new rescue through his death, and to provide completely for his people. Now, mention of the child in verse 9. There's a boy here who's got 5 barley loaves and 2 fish. What are they for so many? He is there to heighten the need and the size of the miracle. Verse 12, the crowds are satisfied when they had eaten their fill. And the leftovers, gather up the leftover fragments that none may be lost. So they gather them up and fill 12 baskets with fragments. Now we're told, verse 10, there are 5,000 men present. What was the total crowd? Some estimate that it could have been up to 20,000. All fed by one peasant boy's lunch. Who on earth could do that? The scale of the catering here is phenomenal, isn't it? Who can meet the needs of his people in such a desolate place? Who can use so little to provide for so many? Well, the answer's obvious, isn't it? The God who has always provided for his people. The God who has always more than met the needs of his people. The God who rescues and provides for his people. Jesus. Let's look on to verse 14 and the conclusion of the people. Jesus is the prophet. When the people saw the sign that he had done, they said, "This is indeed the prophet who is to come into the world." Now, Moses was the leader who led Israel out of Egypt. So it's no surprise that at this point, their thoughts turn to him. And in Deuteronomy chapter 18, First, Moses says, a prophet like him will come. The Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me. It's to him you shall listen. And then God himself says, I will raise up for them a prophet like you from among their brothers, and I will put my words into his mouth, and he shall speak to them all that I command him. Now, back in chapter 5, just glance across to verse 30 at the top of the first column there, Jesus says, I can do nothing on my own. He was completely dependent on what the Father would do and did do, both in terms of his works, his deeds, but also in terms of his words. And as we saw last time, it's through his words that Jesus will accomplish the greater works of bringing life to the world and of being the judge of the world. And the command from Deuteronomy is there, isn't it? To him you shall listen. The people are to listen to Jesus. And late in Deuteronomy 18, the consequences for not doing so are chillingly spelled out. Now, as we can see, this miracle is directed towards Jewish people. It's the people of Galilee who have followed Jesus around the lake into the wilderness. But later in chapter 6, we're going to discover that Jesus' words aren't just for Jews. Therefore, whoever believes has eternal life. And that's great good news, isn't it? Because all of us are included. All of us must meet this challenge to listen to him. All of us face those chilling consequences of not doing so. So, who are you listening to? When it comes to questions of eternity, when it comes to questions of meeting your deepest and greatest needs, who are you turning to? In an article in last week's Observer, David Mitchell of Mitchell and Webb and latterly of Shakespeare fame wrote this. I totally accept that for all practical purposes, there is no such thing as objective truth. But that doesn't necessarily mean it's not worth searching for. And again, we can agree on the theoretical existence somewhere of a definitive truth. Are we still up for seeking that truth? Or are we happy to compound our own subjectivity by being ever more protected from views we oppose? Now, earlier in the article, he has railed against trigger warnings in university lectures. He's railed against safe spaces. He's railed against people being no-platformed. By being ever more protected from views we oppose, and only exposed to advertising designed exclusively for our particular tribe. It's ironic that the advent of a technology facilitating unprecedented communication and understanding of the paradoxes and complexity of global events and of billions of people's reactions to them is causing us to retreat from such knowledge. The apple's tasting funny, and we long for the peace of the garden. He's alluded to being driven out of the Garden of Eden earlier in the article. And I think that's a very poignant conclusion to the article. He seems to be saying there must be more to life than this. He must be saying that our present engagement with our world and truth is simply inadequate and is denying us so much. It's not providing us the satisfaction or the peace that we long for. And at root, he sees our self-selecting narrow-mindedness, our unwillingness to engage with all that's going on in our world as the problem. And it seems to me that fear of engaging with other views lies at the heart of what's been happening with the rejection of Christianity being taught in some of our schools locally. There's no interest in a view that is contrary to my narrow view, and therefore any discussion must be shut down. Now, what's being said is my children must be protected, but I don't think it's the children at all. I think the parents are protecting themselves. That's what's really going on. They don't want to engage, just in case they may encounter this truth, and this truth may challenge them and change them. So if you sit here tonight as someone who is yet to make up their mind, let me encourage you to follow David Mitchell's advice. Seek the truth. It is worth searching for. And for those of us who do follow Jesus, I hope his words will give you a confidence that we do have this definitive, absolute truth that our world is desperate for. And so we will have a confidence to talk about Jesus, because through him is the only way we'll find what satisfies, the only way that we'll get back to the garden. In the meantime, let's make sure that we're those who will listen to and go on listening to Jesus. He is our teacher. He is our saviour. He is the one who provides for all of our needs. Jesus is the prophet. And then in verse 15, Jesus is the king. Perceiving then that they were about to come and take him by force to make him king, Jesus withdrew again to the mountain by himself. Jesus is the king, but is not to be revealed as king for them then and there. We may wonder how on earth in their thinking they got from the Jesus who has fed them on the hillside to Jesus being the prophet to let's make him king. There's no evidence that there were any ever any messianic expectations around that Moses figure from Deuteronomy. Most likely, this is all to do with a nationalistic fervor that was built up around the time of Passover. Now, I'm sure you recognize that very handsome fellow on the screen. He is, of course, Herod Antipas, the ruler of Galilee at this period, but who was nothing more than a puppet of the Romans. What better way, they were thinking, what better way to mark Passover this year than to foment an uprising against this proxy ruler? And look, Jesus, they said, we've got 5,000 men who will march your back and support you. Now, unlike what's going on between Catalonia and Spain at the moment, this would have been no declaration of independence followed by an imposition of direct rule. This would have been bloodshed. This would have been death for the leaders. So knowing what was in their minds, perceiving that they were about to come and take him by force, Jesus departs. Because he knows that these Galileans are not to be trusted. He knows what is in the heart of all people. Back in chapter 2, we read these words. Now, when Jesus was in Jerusalem at the Passover feast, many believed in his name when they saw the signs that he was doing. But Jesus, on his part, did not entrust himself to them because he knew all people. And he needed no one to bear witness about man, for he himself knew what was in man. He knows that humanity wants to use God, use him for their own ends. Now, you and I may not want to overthrow a government. Okay, you may want to overthrow a government. Yes, good. You may. But I guess many of us will have a bucket list. We'll have things that we'd like God to do for us. to provide for us, to change for us. And I imagine we might have a bit of a time scale on this as well. Maybe it's to do with the job we have got but are not satisfied with, or the job that we haven't got. Maybe it's to do with a university place in the next couple of years or so. Maybe it's about a relationship we'd like to have. Maybe you'd like God to sort out the fact that life must be more than just about managing, surely. Or maybe you'd like him to resolve your struggles with mental health. We've got a list. We know what we'd like God to do for us, wouldn't we? We know how our lives would be better if only he'd step up to the plate and do it for us. That's the sort of king we want, just like the Galileans. We want to use God for our own ends. We want to use God to make our lives better, easier, happier. But because he really is king, then we're called on to trust him. To trust him as the generous rescuer provider that we've already met in the chapter. To trust him to meet our needs as he knows best. Jobs, education, relationships, money, and health. We must trust King Jesus and behave rightly towards him, not expecting him to serve us, but rather serving him. Because in due time, he will reveal himself as king. Therefore, today, we must serve him. Jesus is the king. So John says to you, given what you've seen and heard of Jesus tonight, which Jesus will you believe in? Do you want the sign or the sign giver?